So then a move to the States, and, you know, we obviously see the USA women have come on leaps and bounds, particularly in the last 3 or 4 years. Do you see that being some of the groundwork that you put in those earlier days coming to fruition?
No, USA is a very different kettle of fish. It's its own style of programming. It's got the best women's programming in the world with reference to colleges. If you can play hockey reasonably well as a female and you're relatively smart, you can get a college scholarship there, and it's the best program around. It really, really is very, very good. In my view, it doesn't happen for men at all in America, so it's virtually all women's, the women's side. But I went there as a technical director, and I did a lot of work in the development phase and tried to get them to understand a little bit more about the culture of the game and how to play it. I worked at grassroots level through to college level, and obviously was involved with the national program as well, both the women and the men. In actual fact, pretty hard work with the men. I remember going there, and we only had about 25 or 26 players, and we finished up with several hundred, but we did okay with the men. I mean, the men were, I remember having success at beating Argentina and beating Canada and so on and so forth. That was quite an experience, but the women's program was the major one. And, there wasn't any doubt that, from that side, there's no doubt that we set a huge base network for them, I think that's part of what's going on now. They let it lapse, all the development of the coaching. I think they're trying to reinstitute it now. But yeah, I'm sure that Lee Bottomead, and who was the national coach in America, made a huge impact with the way that the game has developed.
And is there a future for the men's game in the United States?
I think it's really hard to be anything but pragmatic about it. No. I think it's very, very difficult when you've got ice hockey and you've got American football and you've got basketball and baseball. It's pretty hard to find other sports, but they've found a few others. You know, they've got soccer going and that's up and running, but it's hockey is not one of the hockey runs so close to their hockey is ice hockey, you know, and it's not something you can break into. And unless you've got a college appeal, that is, you can get a scholarship to go into colleges to play the sport. American sport's very different. Basically, kids play sport a little bit when they're younger. They get into colleges and they really start to play sport. And at the end of their college experience, that's it. They finish. And they're either a professional athlete, a professional player of some sort, or they're done. So I think the situation in America is very, very different. They can become a huge powerhouse in women's hockey if they really put their mind to it. There's no question about that. But the world of our sport is really, it's an interesting place that we find ourselves today. Everyone's striving to be, you know, a professional from the point of view of financing the players to be able to play as a livelihood. And that's a pretty big ask for our sport, and I'm not sure really whether or not we're capable of being able to provide that.
Is there the commercial interest in the women's game in America?
If they were successful, yes. If they were successful internationally, there's no question that could come along. But you've got to be successful, and that means as their women's football or soccer has been, and their basketball, of course, with the women's basketball program, it doesn't draw anything like the NBA. But you know, they still have professional leagues, as they do with pretty well everything else. But the college system is where it all happens. The college system is just an amazing animal in its own entity. It's just incredible. It's like a mini Olympics every week that they have for football games and so on. I remember going to the college football game and being a guest in Michigan, you know, 100,000 plus people just at a college football game. just incredible, just amazing to see how it works and how it ticks over. The American sporting machinery is just very different to anywhere else in the world that I've seen sport being used as a tool for incomes, if you like, for athletes and for players.
Terry, there's no doubt that the college system is the basis of everything to do with athletics in America. I mean, that, there wouldn't be any athletes in America if there was not a college system.
Yeah, I think you're right. You're absolutely right. The issue is, of course, that the greater the NCAA becomes, and you've got to remember the NCAA is just being peppered all the time with legal suits. It's got more legal suits than any other sporting body, as well as being the biggest sporting body probably in the world. It's it provides an enormous basis for youngsters to develop. And then in the professional sports like basketball, and kids at high school are having to make the choice, do I go to college and go through that process, which puts me out of the realm of going into the next stage of international or, you know, the NBA of basketball, and untouchable, if you like, in the college system, or theoretically untouchable. I'm not sure that they are untouchable. All these young footballers and so on in basketball, in colleges, seem to drive around in big cars and live in big houses. So I don't know how that works, but they're not supposed to be financed at all. But that's the system. You know, that's the system. And like every other system, you have an opinion on it, but in the end, your opinion, you have to understand how the culture works. And most of the time, the culture is at loggerheads with your own culture, and you have to always put that aside. Otherwise, it just doesn't work for you. You just it's too hard if you try and bring your own culture into another culture and try and change things accordingly. Just in my view, that's a very dangerous thing, and probably it'd be one piece of advice I'd have for coaches who do go internationally, and that is, you know, try and change the way things work too much. However, if countries want you to make change, there has to be a relative equation, if you like. There has to be change made, otherwise you don't bring about change. It's pretty simple. So it's a very tight line that you walk. You don't want to step across it too much, I don't think.
Well, it's a perfect segue into your experiences with India and the hockey culture and the wider culture there. Can you tell us a little bit about your time there?
Yeah, look, that was a fantastic experience, because India in our sport is the history of our sport, if you like, is Indian hockey. And we've always, in my era, we used to absolutely just put everything down to go and see a game between Pakistan and India. It was just what you wanted to do and what you wanted to see. And we were very fortunate, because the Australian team playing against Pakistan became that sort of game back in that era, back in the 60s and 70s and 80s. That was really the game that people wanted to see those three teams play, because of the way that they played, in a very offensive, risk-taking way, if you like. And the Indian way, of course, is very artistic. The flamboyance and the artistry of being able to redirection the movement or eliminate a player, that's what people went to watch. They didn't go to watch something with power and all the rest of it. They're not interested in that. They're really looking for the artistry and the ability to see people do things that are really, really clever. And that's still in parts of India exists today. A lot of people want to see that, and of course you can't win internationally and be really effective if that's the only way you play. You have to combine that, and in my view, I used to refer to it as the Indian masala with the team, and a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and they were able to bring that up. We managed to discipline them enough to be able to use some of the let's call them the Western way of playing hockey, some of the disciplines that you require to actually play the game effectively, but still leave an opening so that they could use this exciting and unpredictable piece of the game, which really brought to light the spectators. And I thoroughly enjoyed that part of it, being able to try and combine the two without trying to totally overrun them with a Western style or the Australian style, or indeed, as is the case, the European style. I think that just kills the lifeblood of the Indian game. And so the Indian style of game is just incredible. The ability to do things with the ball and set people off balance and make movement patterns and so on is really, really delightful. But their ability to be disciplined is equally frustrating because they just they can be disciplined for a period of time, and then all of a sudden when it's most critical, they seemingly push the undisciplined button, you know, and do something that's totally against. Now, if you can match it well, I think you can create a really good group. And my most successful time with Indians, I mean, we were able to win the Asian Games and so on with the Indian team. I was only there for 12 months, but we changed things around enough to be able to get some results. But the best time of watching them play was when they were here in Perth, which was my last time with the Indian side. They played some really, really watchable and dynamic hockey, you know, as did the Australian guys as well. But the Indian guys, I thought, were outstanding. They did some really, really good things, and I'm well aware that the Australians didn't have their very best side. So it wasn't as though it was Australia versus India in the top context. But just watching the Indians play and bringing some of the artistry and the grace of the game combined with some of the disciplines that are required to play the modern game. I think that was one of my cherished coaching periods.
So you had some time with Kalinga Lancers in the Hockey India League, and you just talked a little bit about the cultural blend between the Indian style and maybe some of the more Western ways. Do you think Hockey India League is having a positive impact on Indian hockey?
I think it has. There's no question that having a lot of players come in from outside has had a fairly impactful outcome on the sport in India. The question is, where is it going? And that's a dilemma that I think our sport faces, you know, across the globe. The situation is that, you know, you've got players earning $100,000 US for 6 or 8 weeks or whatever of playing the game. And I still remember my time with the Kalinga Lancers when I was involved in this process, this whole bidding process for players. And I insisted that the lowest level of payment was $2,400 or $2,800 US, which all went to the Indian players. So if you got an Indian player, that's what they got. And I thought that was really unfair. Really, really unfair. Now, I was quite happy to live with a fairly low amount for a couple of the youngsters who we had with the Kalinga Lancers, which I put down as 6,000. But the minimum other than that was 8,000 for these players, in my view, because it was not fair to have someone playing for $2,800 and another player playing for $70,000. I mean, it's pretty hard to control a team when you've got that discrepancy just in the incomes. And in that culture, in that place, finances are huge. They're really, really important. And we all understand the difference between, you know, the income relatively in Holland to that of India, or that of Australia and India, or Argentina and so on. But they're all different, and I think you have to be respectful of that. And I remember making a stance on that at that point, which was not well received necessarily by the administration, but I thought it was very important to, you know, to at least enhance the income of the kids from India to a level which I thought was in somewhat a more commensurate way than what was set up. But yeah, it's doing a good job. What's going to happen? I don't know. I mean, I watched the last Indian League, and I know they're having trouble with getting franchises and the difficulty with the whole piece. I hope it does continue. I really do hope it continues. Also, we started a league in Malaysia at roughly the same time, and the money's nowhere near the same, but there's money there for players to earn if they want to go and play in the Malaysian league, and that's going to grow, I'm sure, over the period. And certainly they get much more money playing in the Malaysian league than they do get playing in the Perth league, for example. And so opportunities are going to be there, but in the end it's going to be a dollar driven game, because to have the professional players means you've got to pay a fair bit of money out. And a lot of the solutions we see in sports like rugby, it's very, very expensive, and you've got to be very careful how much you spend on the very top tier and the money you don't spend in your development. Because if you want your players to come through in quality, then you have to have a development program that somehow works. And we all know that things have changed. The volunteer in the sporting world today, working in clubs, they're far fewer. They used to be everywhere. Everybody got volunteered their time, but no more. People don't volunteer their time anywhere near the way that they used to, and so costs keep escalating. And you try and put 15 or 20 people on a plane to go anywhere, it doesn't matter whether they're old, young, green, black, blue. You know, it costs you a lot of money to get on a plane. And when you start playing international sport and you want to play things like home and away competitions, there's a huge amount of money that gets given to the travel industry.
That's a good point. Now, Terry, your career started playing on grass. You saw the transition from traditional hockey, let's call it, to what might be called synthetic hockey these days. And the skills, it must be said, are tremendous. The players today are tremendously athletic and they're very skillful, except, I think, in the area of trapping. And it irritates me. It irritates me constantly to see blokes lying their stick, or women, flat on the ground to stop a ball and it bounce over the top.
Yeah, I think it's a good observation. I think a lot of the time people don't understand what receiving the ball is all about. A lot of people are either coached or they learn that receiving the ball is basically stopping the ball going in that direction and then being able to restart it going in another direction after you've stopped it. Not many learn the art of being able to receive the ball in a mobile fashion and move off. Particularly if it's bouncing, you know, having things like your left hand in front of your right, so your left hand's close to where the ball's come from, so your stick's actually on an angle and going downwards, but it's virtually vertical. And having your eye, the ball, and the stick all in the one plane, those things are seemingly old-fashioned, but they work a lot. They work really, really well, and I'll give you a very good example of it. And In 2004, in the final at the Olympics between Australia and Holland, Holland are horrific across the board at receiving a bouncing ball. They don't know how to do it. They put their feet together and stand in a vertical way, upright behind the ball. And the reason I mention that is because in the last game in Athens at the Olympics, it was a very windy night, and it basically dried out the pitch, and the pitch was terrible to say the least to begin with, but without any moisture on it was horrific, and the ball would just scuttle all over the place and bounce and bobble, and the Australian guys could trap very, very effectively, and on the international scene it's fair to say the Australians are better than most. So I'm glad you don't live in Holland or somewhere like that, otherwise you'd be furious about this sort of receiving technique. But the ability to get your left elbow up in a cricketing type fashion is easy for the Pakistanis and the Australians, even the English and Australians, we do that very, very easily. But for countries who don't have that ability to put their left elbow up and play a defensive cricket stroke type thing, it's not natural, and they find it very, very difficult. And the Europeans particularly just lie their flat out stick on the ground, and a lot of our youngsters do as well. Last time I coached in Perth, first division team. We actually train once a week on grass specifically so that people learn how to trap the ball a little better and cope with the ball being able to move in a slightly unpredictable manner on the pitch. So I agree with you. I think that the receiving technique and the ability to move in a mobile manner after receiving the ball, combined with sticks. I mean, sticks are just rock hard now. They're so stiff. And kids like to have them, the stiffer the better, because they can hit the ball harder, or they think they can hit the ball harder. The problem is they can't trap it to hit it. And, because when the ball touches it, when they trap it, it bounces off by 15 centimetres or 20 centimetres. And they spend the next 2 seconds trying to get the ball into a place where they can make a pass. Yeah, it's very frustrating. Wooden sticks allowed you to receive the ball. I remember Stephen Davies, who was a great striker for Australia in 1999. We actually took him away from a synthetic stick and put him onto a wooden stick. And he had the best season of his life. He was a great player, but he was actually able to keep the ball right on his blade, which is part of the art of playing in the modern game, really.
We'll be talking to Mike Smith from the Hockey Museum again. We've spoken to him recently, but speaking to him about the stick development over the years and where we've gone from and what we have now. I don't think you can get a wooden stick anymore, can you?
You can, yeah, you can, but you've got to know where to go to get them. It's not as though young kids are going to find those in the stores. They're all synthetic now, and as I say, people want to, if you get a $400 stick versus a $200 stick, the kids all want the $400 stick because it's better, and all it is just got a lot more hardened, synthetic material in it. So it's really, really, really stiff. Quite honestly, if I was to give some advice to young kids, I'd be picking the $50 stick, one that's got a little bit of flex in it. I think you'd find that they'd be able to play the game a little more effectively.
Do you know of any top players today that have got that sort of composition on their sticks?
A few of the players use slightly softened sticks, but most of them, the base level of stick is just rock hard, just hard as you can get. And of course, for those who have been around our game for a long time, remember the almost like the cricket handle grip that went through the top of the hockey sticks, and you could bend the stick would just move as you leant on it, and then you started to move away from that. And Hazel was very big, with the Griffin stick initially. I remember he used to carry bundles of hardener and all this carbon fiber just to stiffen sticks up everywhere, and yeah, he used to love playing with a really stiff stick, but compared to today, today's world of hockey sticks, they're all like that and more. They're just really rigid. And the control mechanism, being able to play the game with a lot of control, is much harder today than with a really rigid stick than it is with a softer stick. And not for 1 minute am I saying going back to the 40s and the 50s where the sticks used to sort of swivel in your hand. But I think there is a sensible blend there. I really do.
Terry, it's been fantastic talking to you today. We could go on for hours, but we've got to wrap things up at some stage. But I did have one more question I wanted to ask you. You're a phenomenal goal scorer, and you know a fair bit about the game. I've spent my entire career, except for the last 2 years, playing in the back line, and I suddenly find myself thrust into the forward line at 50 years of age. And I've just discovered that when you're in the forward line, people expect you to score goals, which is not something I've ever been used to doing before. Have you got any tips?
Excuse me. A 50-year-old playing in this front, well, I would take a strong tablet with humility in it, and I would not try to hit the ball hard. I would just try to get the ball going towards the goal. and I would not have any great expectation. I would just put enjoyment in front of expectation. You'd be surprised. If you do a few simple things, you can do okay. I mean, if you just don't try to move too much and stay relatively stationary, right, and let the ball come to you, you'll be surprised how often you'll score if you're patient rather than running. 50-year-old running is not as easy as a 20-year-old running. So you use up a lot of energy and ability as you're moving.
Oh, look, Terry, it's been tremendous talking to you. All the best. I think you finish up with Malaysia sometime this year, do you?
Yeah, well, we've got a couple of World League Threes that we're going to. Our women have miraculously got into the World League Three, in my view, but they've done a very, very good job. They've just got five to six years of development to go before they can legitimately, in my view, take on the best teams in the world. But they're in there and they're giving it a go. And the men's team, I think, are pretty reasonable. If they get things right, they can be a real threat on the international scene. That all happens over the next couple of weeks. And the Australian girls are in the same tournament in Brussels as the Malaysian girls, and the Australian men are in Africa, which is not the tournament that the Malaysian men are in.
Okay. We actually need to get someone on from the FIH to explain to us the whole World Hockey League, because it can be a bit confusing at times.
Well, yeah, it is a confusing setup, but in simple terms, the way it runs today is not the way it's going to run tomorrow, so it's probably not necessarily worthwhile going through it. But in simple terms, at the moment, we have World League 1, World League 2, World League 3, and World League 4. World League 4 is the final one. There's only 8 teams in that, and they're the top 4 teams from the World League 3 tournaments, which there are 2 of. And then underneath the World League 3, there are usually 4 World League 2s. And then there's an infinite number of World League 1s that take place to get you into World League 2. And that takes place over a 2-year cycle. So you have a World Cup to an Olympic cycle, and then an Olympic to a World Cup cycle, those 2-year periods. And that's simply what it is. The World League 1s and the World League 2s take place in the first year of the cycle, and World League 3, World League 4 take place in the second year of the cycle. Yep. So that's where we are right now, and that falls before the next Olympic Games, or the next World Cup. So for us, 2017, you'll have World League 3 and World League 4, and then the World Cup will be in 2018.
And then it's a bit of a watch this space for the new home and away concept.
Yeah, which will be very, very interesting. I'll be very interested to see how that all pans out into the future, because that's one of these exercises in putting a lot of people onto planes.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And I keep telling people, especially in this country, Australia, that's something that really kills our ability to promote these sorts of events and get them going, is the travel factor is just so enormous.
Yeah, well, I think that, I mean, the premise is that you'll get a lot of people to come and watch the event because you're playing home and away. And I'd like to think that that was the case, that you might be able to bring in 10,000 or 15,000 people to watch an event. I'm just not convinced that that's going to take place in some of these countries that are going to be involved. But I hope let's see what happens. Let's see what happens. I really hope it's successful and hockey can take another step into the future. But the world is evolving and the world is changing, as we all know, and so is hockey.
Look, Terry, there's so much more we wanted to talk to you about today. There is, honestly, your CV is huge. We've barely scratched the surface. Perhaps in the future we can have another chat to you and discuss some of the issues that we didn't quite get to today.
No problem. Look, thanks for your time and thanks for your interest and thanks for what you do for our sport. It's fantastic. Good on you.
Thanks, Terry.
Cheers, Terry.
Cheers.